so I guess the group, 4, 5, and 6 should hand in their space mini commentaries today. If you haven't. Okay. We are about to hunker down for 4 or 5 weeks into the deduction, and it's just going to go slow and be painful, but like your mother told you, all these painful things are good for you, and we're going to see what we can to get through it all. Last week we ended, or I meant to end, with what I called a non-skeptical conception of transcendental idealism, of which the simplest statement is simply that there cannot be any form of a conceptual scheme world dualism. That the thought that no appearance is only not things in themselves is just a way of stating, and I'm quoting now Hilary Putnam in his essay Convention for Realism and Reason. He says, Kant taught us that the whole idea of comparing our conceptual scheme with a world of things in themselves, which Kant in fact did accept as a postulate of reason, Kant told us to see that if the conceptual system copies the unconceptualized reality, it's incoherent. That if we can only know the world as conceptualized, and we can't even begin to ask the question, right, whether it copies or corresponds to unconceptualized reality, since we have no notion of such an unconceptualized reality, no access to it, and therefore we have only to do with appearances. Share here. And I wanted today to get at this issue. What I'm going to hope to do today is do what is called the metaphysical deduction, and then an introduction to the deduction in A. Let's start at the beginning. The very beginning of the logic in general. And one of the things, I guess I want to say a few things, let me just be clear. For those of you who have been doing Kant for a while, you will find my account deflationary in two respects. One is that I have a much more modest conception of what a transcendental deduction involves, and secondly, I have an almost negligible conception of self-consciousness. So I think that a lot of the topics that people worry about and critique are just not there. I think they're inventions, mostly of Fichte, which isn't to say Fichte isn't interesting, but they're inventions nonetheless. For those of you who don't know Kant, I'm letting you know my account is deflationary. And it all hangs for me, and this is the reason why I'm one of the old-fashioned sorts who begins with the metaphysical deduction, that really the whole of the transcendental deduction is really about what we mean by judgment and what we mean by our knowledge being discursive. That is really to be an unpacking of those two ideas. And that we can and unpack them successfully, all the heavy duty Kantian ideas should, with any luck, given fair weather and good wind and a sunny day, we may end up not thinking. Our knowledge, he says, springs from two fundamental sources of the mind. So at the very beginning of the logic, Kant repeats what I have claimed is his great insight, namely that knowledge has two irreducible sources. And that's really, as I want to repeat and repeat, the key to the whole critique. I'm just going to be really good. The first is the capacity of receiving representations. The second is the power of knowledge, knowing an object through representation. Spontaneity. And the production of concepts. You should be, if you are of a nervous disposition, feeling nervous and anxious. Spontaneity in the production of concepts. That should strike you as a deeply, deeply puzzling thought. Why should it be puzzling? Anyway. What would make it puzzling?
Where do you get the production from? Is it the translation of the production?
Yeah. As an interpolation. So, Kent Smith, interpolation.
Oh.
Yeah?
If our knowledge of the world is formed by concepts, then how does the concept form the rest of the world?
That's almost too quick, although that's something like the problem. Yes?
Yeah, spontaneous is normally at a random and an individual. Why the concept that you general?
Okay, spontaneity seems like the very opposite of objectivity. Seems like the very opposite of knowledge. Seems like the very opposite of getting hold of the world. Spontaneity is what we do when we're unconstrained, when we're having a good time, when all the rules are being broken. So he's taking the very concept, spontaneity, and turning it the other way. Yeah?
For me, actually, I find that spontaneity is actually an unfortunate word of Kant's truth. Actually, he wanted to express the activeness. For me, maybe activeness is more.
Certainly, activity is part of it, but spontaneity, too, in the sense that if they're not concepts that are abstracted from the world, it's just Copernican term in a little way, right? We haven't got these concepts, whatever they are, they're going to be categories. We haven't learned them from the phenomena. We're not constrained by the phenomena producing them. They seem to come, to arise of their own. Right? So, of course, activity is important. Kant gives the notion of activity, we'll get to it, a huge role. But spontaneity is important, too, because it shows the sense in which we're not trying to copy the world, or they're not empirical, and they're expressive of us and our activities. Through the first, an object is given to us. Through the second, the object is thought in relation to that given representation, which is a mere determination of mind. And then he reminds us that intuitions and concepts can be either empirical or a priori. The pure concept, he says, is only the form of the thought of an object in general. Pure intuitions or pure concepts alone are possible a priori. And then on the top of the following page, continuing on the next paragraph, if the receptivity of our mind is the power of receiving representations insofar as anyone's affected, which it entitles sensibility, then the mind's power of producing representations from itself, the spontaneity of knowledge, should be called the understanding. And again, that should almost strike you as oxymoronic. The power of producing representations and concepts from out of its own powers should be called understanding. Our nature is so constituted that our intuition can never be the other than sensible. That is, it contains only the mode in which we are affected by the object. The faculty, on the other hand, which enables us to think the object of sensible intuition, is the understanding. So intuitions are that through which representations are given, and the understanding is that through which representations are thought. And obviously that's connect enough, that's a good story. But our first question is simply this. Which concepts have their seat solely in the understanding? Or, let's put the thought another way, what grounds are there for believing that some concepts have their seat in the understanding? Why should we think that we make this contribution to knowledge rather than merely receive it? Well, there is an easy negative answer to this. The concepts that are going to have their seat in the understanding are just those for which we lack an impression, just those that are not learned from experience. In short, the ones that we're going to produce from the understanding turn out to be just those that you, in his desperate quest to find verification, failed. Right? So you was right. There is no impression corresponding to cause, corresponding to substance, corresponding to self. Right? All those famous passages in Hume, he was right. So Kant says at A91, where he gives Hume his due, the new paragraph there, if we thought to escape these toilsome inquiries by saying that experience continually presents examples of such regularity among appearances, and so affords abundant opportunity of abstracting the concept of cause. Now he's just repeating the argument of the treatise here, right? And at the same time of verifying the objective validity of such a concept, we should be overlooking the fact that the concept of cause can never arise in this manner. It must either be grounded completely a priori in the understanding, or must be entirely given up as a mere phantom of the brain. You took it, let's remind ourselves, that it was a mere phantom of the brain, right? He never denied we needed the concept, but there was no ground for it. It was just a mere phantom of the brain, something we're drawn to. Right? So he's just saying, it's either me or you, take your pick. Just upping the ante.
And
important move to realize that if we want to make use of a fundamental concept, the concept that Hume said was the glue of the universe, we have a choice. Either it's a figment of our imagination, which is one concept of spontaneity, or it has an a priori validity. The Kantian notion of what we can do with spontaneity. So, cause, come what may, is derived from spontaneity. The only question is it one of fantasy, or is it, in some sense, going to be validated? So he goes on, for this concept makes strict demand that something A should be such that something else B follows. It necessarily, in accordance with an absolutely universal rule, appearances do present cases from which a rule can be obtained according to which something usually happens, but they never prove the sequence to be necessary. So what Kant will need to demonstrate is that the concepts Hume denies, this notion of self, notion of substance, notion of cause, primarily, are somehow necessary or indispensable or presupposed for knowledge. But in a way, and we must be careful here, in a way, Hume kind of agrees with that too. He doesn't think he can do without the notion of cause. So he thinks, in a way, it's kind of necessary. It's just that it's a fantasy, right? That's why he's a skeptic. So that his naturalism, right, is a way of saying we must help ourselves to what we need, but we're not entitled to do so. So it's not exactly over necessity that they differ, it's over the rationality of that necessity. So we're going to need to move to somehow a deeper level. And that deeper level Kant thinks is going to be had by thinking about what is necessary for the possibility of judgment. So he gives a hint here of what he's thinking about. At A89, I'm going through this just, I'm getting passages here because I know reading it is difficult and I want you to get a little bit familiar with Kant's language.
A89,
B122. It's really toward the end of A89, the very beginning of B122. Where he says, the categories of understanding, on the other hand, do not represent the conditions under which objects are given in intuition. Space and time are the conditions under which objects are given in intuition. Objects, therefore, may appear to us without their being under the necessity being related to the functions of the understanding. An understanding need not, therefore, contain their a priori conditions. Thus, a difficulty such as we did not meet in the field of sensibility is here presented. Namely, how objective conditions of thought and have objective validity. That is, can furnish conditions of the possibility of all knowledge of objects. I take it that's the question Kant is trying to ask. That is, how is it possible for the subjective conditions of thought, and I'll have to show that's a spontaneous concept we need, the categories, are subjective conditions of thought, right, can have objective validity. So he's acknowledging that the necessity in the first instance is subjective. Right? My way of encountering the world. And therefore there's a kind of puzzle. Why should it be the case that what is necessary for my mere subjectivity should not be a source of error, but a condition of objectivity? In other words, look, we typically think that when we say, that was a subjective comment, we mean that your subjectivity got in the way of you seeing reality. Subjectivity, or being subjective, is a term of abuse. And it was a term of abuse during Kant's time. He knew that what calling something subjective meant not objective, not of the world. So now we've kind of, he's upping the ante now. So we know we got the spontaneity of thought, and now we know the spontaneity is something to do with our subjectivity, just subjective conditions of thought, and that these subjective conditions are going to need to have objective validity. Where the notion of objective validity has to be stronger than, I think, the mere thought that, well, let's use a kind of Rorgian phrase, that's the way we do things. We human beings, we do that. Right? That would just be hyper-conventionalist. Kant wants something deeper than that. Right? He wants something about our subjectivity to be deep, so that at the very center of our subjectivity is not our elimination from the world, but our access to it. And furthermore, seems to suggest at A85 that at the end of the day, the very idea of a transcendental deduction is going to be bound up with filling this gap, or how do you go here? Explaining is the word he's going to use. Explaining how the gap between subjectivity, spontaneity on the one hand, and objectivity on the other can be filled. So he says, new paragraph, so I'm giving you, this is as weak a conception of what a transcendental deduction is that I know of, and also the kind of least mysterious, maybe the most disappointing. false. It turns out it's not an anti-skeptical one. But anyway, I'll come back to that in about 5 minutes. He says, now, among the manifold concepts which form the highly complicated web of human knowledge, there are some which are marked out in pure a priori employment in complete independence of all experience. And their right to be so employed always demands a deduction. The deduction now is the right for of us to employ these spontaneous, subjective concepts that have their seat in the understanding. That's why we ask the question of right is, what entitlement do we have to make use of these things? We need some sort of account. And he's assuming that Hume's naturalistic account is not that. And he goes on to say, for since empirical proofs do not suffice to justify their employment, which is roughly what Locke and Hume did, we are faced by the problem of how these concepts can relate to objects which they yet do not obtain from any experience. And it's the next sentence that I'm claiming is the definition of the transcendental deduction. The explanation, and I'm saying this, by the way, not to be perverse, but because he said it. Beware that I'm even perverse, but my perversity is common. The explanation of the manner in which concepts can thus relate a priori to objects, I entitle their transcendental deduction. The manner. Now the next sentence is, and the crucial thing is, the first word there, the explanation of the manner. Is their transcendental deduction. So the explanation of how it is that concepts that have their feet in the understanding and are spontaneous and subjective, the explanation of how they, right, apply to objects a priori is their transcendental deduction. So, in a way, transcendental deduction is no more nor less than an analysis, I want to say, of what we mean by discursive cognition, since discursive cognition is just cognition by means of concepts. And if we're going to show that we can't think without concepts, and particularly we can't think without the concepts that have their role in the understanding, then explaining how it is they apply, the explanation of that is their deduction. So that's all transcendental deduction is, a kind of explanation, which means that, what? That at least the way I'm doing it, this is not structurally an argument against skepticism. The transcendental deductions are not meant to defeat skepticism. Indeed, I'll try to show you that from the get-go, the notion of skepticism is unintelligible for Kant. And it's unintelligible for Kant because I'll suggest that subject about dualism is unintelligible for Kant. So I'm trying to, as it were, not make things less complicated. They're complicated enough. But I think that they're also much more streamlined than at least some accounts have. Or at least that's what I'm trying to talk about. Okay, well, how are we to get all of this going? How are we to kind of said what the puzzle is. Let me repeat. The puzzle is that there are two sources of knowledge. are not derived from experience. Therefore, it looks as if the very notion of understanding and thinking involves us in the use of concepts that spring from our intellect, from the spontaneity, and that we therefore must figure out a way of showing why what is subjective and spontaneous is objective.
Can you just say, this is so obvious, but what do you mean by dispersion?
Discursive, I'm going to say, is the opposite of intuitive for Kant. So, discursive cognition is going to be cognition by means of concepts where, and then we have to ask what it is to use concepts. And that's the next step. So, I've not quite got what I need to say enough about this. Maybe 40 seconds now.
Yeah. given this really thin account of what a sensible deduction is going to be, how do you make sense of the distinction between the quid fact and the quid juris? Because it seems like the quid juris is just going to be appeal to the fact that we have no choice but to use certain pure concepts. And that does not seem to be a legitimation of anything.
Not quite, because the notion that I suggested, the notion of we have no choice is not adequate, because I suggested that you agree we have no choice. So I need something stronger than we have no choice. I have to show that it's necessary that they have objective validity, because they cash out the very notion, I'm going to say, of what it is for something to be an object. So the notion of necessity has got to be deeper. The sense of weaker is the strategy of explanation, that is, filling in the gap between spontaneity and objectivity, I'm claiming, is explanatory. Right? That's the deduction. So that's the right. And the explanation can be either, you're quite right, a naturalistic explanation, that's how our imagination works, or a logical one, and I'm going to be giving a logical explanation, not a...
But I mean, according to this reading, the practical naturalistic reading is still plausible, in the sense that I could give a naturalistic reading to... No,
because then you're just saying it is a fantasy. The question again is, we're agreeing on spontaneity. The question is, why is it more than fantasy? In other words, why? I mean, one of the things, think of the puzzle this way, is why, of all the dead concepts that pop up into my head when I'm examining regularity, does the concept of cause pop up? So Hume, of course, agrees that it's cause that pops up. And he says something about, well, you know, it makes us feel good to think, you know, kind of gives us a kind of a, what, self-assurance that when I see A, I'm going to see B. But he thinks there's self-insurance, nothing cognitive there. So I want to ground the use of this.
What if you're McDowell?
Yeah, well, McDowell is an anti-transcendental idealist, and I think McDowell can be interpreted either as a super-conventionalist or a super-Platonist. And I don't see how you determine which he is. Transcendental idealism does take the thought, so both of you are pressing hard on this, that the concepts that do have to exceed the understanding are not every concept, but only some concepts. So from Dao or from Wittgenstein, wouldn't matter. You know, from Velsen somewhere, every concept can require a transcendental deduction. I went, no, not every concept. That's crazy. Only those that have their essence purely. So yeah, I think there are some concepts that are special. Right? That's going to be part of the answer against the Tao. And I've got to ground their specialness in a way that connects it with the very idea of knowledge. That's the right pressure. I mean, certainly if my account is vulnerable, this is vulnerable, it's going to be vulnerable from the medallion naturalistic wing because I'm softening the transcendental in a certain way. Sure. Yeah?
I just wonder what the counter then think about the real fantasy, this hallucination. Because the hallucination is also there's also combination of intuition, because in your hallucination I see now a pink panther. I still can see there's space and there's also time, and meanwhile I also have this concept, this object in my hallucination. It's only for example when I dream it, it's the same for me as I see it in reality. For example, it's the same. Only I cannot communicate with other people. Is that the only difference?
Which is a good reason to think your judgment that you're seeing a pink elephant is wrong. It is if you can't locate it in space with other people. I mean, the count is going to have to be able to give a standard account of that. But he's going to have to give an account that makes the standard everyday explanation the right one. Right? Namely, it's not there. It's in your head. Well, the secret, not the secret, or the premise of everything that's going on here is that to know is to judge. Every act of knowing is a judging and Kant takes it that the notion of judging is a irreducible kind of cognitive activity. I want to be clear, when I say irreducible, I mean irreducible. Judgments are not something that we explain. They, and what I'm going to try to unpack, is the idea that they are ground-level phenomena. That the business of judging is what we mean by whether you can do something. And that Kant is then going to say that the catalogs of the forms of judgment will become the guides or the clues or the hints to what the pure concepts of the understanding are. So he says, at A68, plodding on through the metaphysical deduction. So he says, well, you know, so far we've said that the understanding is simply not intuition, not sensible. what else can be said about it? Whereas all intuitions of principle rest on affections, concepts rest on function. And now, Kant goes on and defines function. By function, I mean the unity of the act of bringing various representations under one common representation. Concepts are based on the spontaneity of thought, sensual intuition, but we need to put the impressions. Now, the only use to which the understanding, this is an incredible phrase, the only use to which the understanding can make of concepts is to judge by means of them. Those of you who've been studying in Wittgenstein all your life, this should sound familiar, because the claim now is, right, that the minimal unit we're going to be talking about is a judgment, not a concept, but a judgment. Because we can only figure out what concepts are, what they do, what they mean, how they function, by analyzing the role they play in judgments. Concepts are not the primitive phenomena. Judgments are the primitive phenomena. And the meaning of conceptualization, this is why I couldn't answer your question about discursivity, right? Because I could say, oh, well, thinking by means of concepts. But it turns out the notion of concept is not primitive, right? We don't know what it is to think by concept. We have a different unit of the minimum of thought, namely the notion of a judgment. And it's the role that concepts have in judgment that tells us what concepts can do and how they do it. So we already know the concepts of generality, blah, blah, blah. Since no representation, that's a turning point in the argument. Remember I said last time in the first lecture, I said, look, one of the things that's different in Kant, as opposed to empiricists and rationalists, is they have the idea of cognition as a kind of seeing a simple idea, an immediate act of awareness. And I said, no, Kant thinks we think through concepts, where concepts are general items that, you know, sort out, apply to many different particulars, and that we think of conceptualization or recognizing or using concepts possessing a concept as having a capacity, a recognitional ability, all that kind of stuff. That was my original line about conceptuality versus the seeing model of knowledge. Now I push that thought one step further. I said, no, it's actually not even conceptualization, it's judgment. That in order to have a knowledge claim is to make a judgment. And that concepts get their meaning from the role, the functional role, they play in judgment. One of the best works of neo-Kantianism is Ernst Cassirer's wonderful book called Substance and Function. And the whole book is saying, beforehand, everyone thought about substance, about being. Kant said, give up the notion of being. Think about the function of concepts, the role they play. Don't ask after the meaning of a concept, ask after its use, right? Which is why he and Heidegger, right, were like Muhammad Ali and whatever his name, you know, slugging it out there. Since no representation, save when it is an intuition, is an immediate relation to an object, no concept is ever related to an object immediately, but to some other representation of it, be that other representation intuition or itself a concept. Judgment is therefore the immediate knowledge of an object. Judgment, so discursivity, is mediation all the way down. That's why it's the opposite of intuition, right? Our cognition is discursive in that it is fully mediated. Judgment is therefore the immediate knowledge of an object, that is the representation of a representation of it, etc. Okay. So, and again, over the page 94, just if you have a hammer and you have a nail, hit it over the head. He says, now we can reduce all acts of understanding to judgment. And the understanding may therefore be represented as a faculty of judgment. Okay. It's about judgment. It's all about judgment. How is that going to help us? Well, it's going to help us because what judgments are is functions of unity among concepts. That is, what judgments are, what the logical functions of judgments are the various ways in which one or more concepts can be unified, right? So we have two concepts, a subject concept, a predicate concept, right? And the thought is, right, that the minimal unit in which we can do anything with either of these things is subject, predicate, categorical form of judgment, SST. That there's nothing we could do with the notion of a subject idea or a predicate idea except, right, use it in a judgment. So this form, SST, is a unity of concept. There are a few others. So, the forms of judgment are the various ways in which unity is possible among concepts, irrespective of context. Indeed, you might even say the thought is deeper. It's only in the light, indeed it becomes thought, it's only insofar as we do unify concepts in a judgment that representation represents. Again, I am, what am I saying here? The opposite of this is association of ideas. Right? The empiricist said, yeah. You know, I've got this idea, and I've got that idea, and, you know, whenever I got a red idea, and a round idea, and a sweet idea, I got the apple idea, right? And, you know, that sounds like magic. Kant thinks that, no, it's learning how to put together our so by itself, having an awareness of that, where the lines for the minute, let's say, just represent the redness of the circle. I can have an intuition of this. But it only becomes anything when I articulate it. Namely, when I say the circle is red. Right? That's what takes it from the realm of being mere experience, intuitive experience, into, and that's what we're trying to do, a judgment about an object in the world. Not what I experience, but what's out there. So, the unifying, and Kant's word for unifying, which I'm going to come back to, is synthesizing. So by synthesizing my intuition of this in accordance with the logical function, S is P, I can make the judgment the circle is red. And in making the judgment the circle is red, I am representing, my judgment is a representation of this. Now, if this is right, then it entails that the forms of judgment are a transcendental syntax or a transcendental grammar, by which I mean by which I mean the thought that clearly, S is P, the subject, this belongs to grammar or syntax, not the world. This is part, you might say, of language or vocabulary, the faculty of thought, not about how the world is, but how the mind structures experience. And Kant is saying that our only access, the only thing we can do with the stuff that comes at us and affects us, is to make judgments about it. And therefore, he thinks of the variety of logical forms this is about how we think about the world. And of course, what I want to do is get from grammar to the world, and that's going to be the trick a little bit. But for the moment, it seems obvious, at least at a certain level, that Kant feels compelled by the fact that if we are the kinds of beings who can think about anything only by making judgments about them, then the forms of judgment are the ultimate constraint upon how we go about this. Now, that's not quite enough. The naturalistic problem arises, you might say. This is the way we talk. Something like that. So, Kant has a further thought. And the further thought runs something like the following. This grammar works, that I can make use of this grammar to make judgments about the world if and only if I presuppose that the object of the judgment has a shape that is hospitable to being judged in that way, so that I can use the judgment form F is T, the circle is red, if and only if the world contains substances which have properties. Right? So, let's be very clear. S is T. This is about subjects and predicates. And they are subjects and predicates belong to grammar, not the world. In the world, there aren't subjects of sentences and predicates of those subjects. There are substances and there are properties. So Kant thinks that because we are constrained by this transcendental grammar, then we must, that use of that grammar, suggest a transcendental semantic. That is, a concept of an object. That is, our forms of judging project onto the world the kind of things that are going to count for us as objects of representation, including the fact that there are events, that they change, etc., etc. So that the trick of this story is, this is the metaphysical deduction, is that the requirement that there be a transcendental grammar, the transcendental syntax, entails the necessity of there being a transcendental summon. Well, why if and only if? Let me do the why if and only if, and then I'm going to go back and do the textual stuff. Show you that small concept. Let's fire the subject and pray. What is another, what is not the other logical form of judgment, anyone? Yep, and what's a hypothetical? What's the form? if then. Clearly, if then belongs to grammar, not to the world, okay? So we're clear. Subjects and predicates, we always get confused. But if then, if X, then Y. And that's just the logical form. What do we judge under that form, anyone? Causality, right? So, if X, then Y happens, right? So, cause and effect. And that's your semantics. Now, and here's Kant's genius. He wants to say the following, that this couple, the transcendental grammar and the transcendental semantics, are indeed a married couple that cannot live without one another. In fact, not only cannot live without another, they're unintelligible without one another. Why is that? Because in order to make use of the grammar, if then, to talk about the world, the only use you can make of it is cause and effect. Conversely, if you lack the grammar of the hypothetical, then you cannot make use of the notions of cause and effect. That is only for a being who possesses the capacities to employ hypotheticals can make use of the notion of cause and effect. Now, therefore, the way things cash out in the world, this is our world ontology, our transcendental, these are the categories. And the reason they are the categories, our concept of an object, is because the only way we can make sense of how things go in the world is by judging in accordance with our logical forms of judgment. But our logical forms of judgment only gain a grip on the world if the world is articulated in terms of cause and effect, substance and property, etc., etc. So that our grammar, our epistemic grammar, and our transcendental grammar hang together. And now think about it. If it's the case that no cause and effect without the hypothetical form of judgment, then the notion of cause and effect can't be derived from the world. Because they have an irreducible connection to the a priori grammar of our forms of judgment. That is, that there is about the notion of cause and effect an irreducible sense in which they get their sense by the role they play right? We make the hypothetical judgment. So if that's the case, then the notion of cause and effect don't belong to the world. They belong to our way of thinking about the world. That is, they belong to our transcendental semantics. That is, something that's coordinated with our syntax rather than an independent role in the world. Okay. That's a big mouthful. Let's take a deep breath, have a brief break. I'll come back and look at the text now on all of this. Let's